Today is Wednesday, August 9th, the year 2000. We're in East Lansing, Michigan at the MSU Cyclotron Laboratory. I am Jeff Charnley interviewing Dr. Henry Blosser, who was the founding director of the National Superconducting Cyclotron Laboratory here at Michigan State University. The purpose of this interview is to document the history of Michigan State, especially in the last 50 years, for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in 2005. As you can see, Dr. Blosser, we are tape recording this interview. Do you give us permission to tape?
Oh, I do.
Okay. I'd like to start first with your personal, educational, and professional background. Where did you do your undergraduate work and then graduate work?
Well, I did all of that at the University of Virginia. Did a first year straight out of high school and entering in 1945. And wasn't sure of my goals, and so dropped out for 2 years for an enlistment in the U.S. Navy, and then went back to Virginia in 48, finished a bachelor's degree in 51, master's degree in 52, PhD in 54.
Was there anything in the Navy that that you did that contributed to your later work? Or?
Oh, sure, yes. The thing I spent most time of any activity in the Navy was working in a machine shop on a submarine tender. Mm-hmm. And the shop is very like the one that we've had here all these years. And that's shop's a key part of a successful cyclotron laboratory.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think you chose the career that you did?
Oh, just by accident.
How was that?
Well, I went to college to study business. My father operated a business, a picture of which you see there on the wall, poultry processing. And he had only a sixth grade education, but my mother thought everybody should go to college. I went to the University of Virginia, which was the closest school, and also went there with the hope of making the football team.
Mm-hmm. And did you?
No.
No.
I played, I have something like 5 minutes of playing time in some runaway games. Never got on the traveling squad.
Mm-hmm.
So, went off to the Navy. Came back, and the football team had enormously upgraded with all the veterans back.
Mm-hmm.
And so
you attended on the GI Bill?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How was it that you ultimately came to Michigan State?
Oh, well, let's see. I went from graduate school to a job in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, working in a group there that used cyclotrons. And after a year or two, there was a problem with the cyclotron construction project there. And they offered me the job of group leader in that, which was quite attractive. I've made a pattern of making a turn in my career when something attractive came along, inviting such a turn. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, very much of what brought me to Michigan State. Like couple of guys from the physics department, Bill Kelly and George Beard, came to Oak Ridge looking for people to hit up a cyclotron project, which was being dreamed about. And I had lunch with them one day. And then a bit later, the department head designate, Sherwood Haynes, he was at Vanderbilt but had accepted a position to come to MSU, came over on a day when I was making a presentation at an information meeting about a cyclotron we had built there in Oak Ridge. And he came up afterward and asked me whether I'd be interested in a position here and gave a sales pitch about the attractive administration support which existed here. So came for an interview in January of 58 and accepted a job in February of 58.
Very. Mm-hmm. Did you have any early contact with President Hanna?
Didn't see him on the interview trip. A lot of contact in the early years of the project when we were fighting to get federal money. I particularly remember an interview session in which a research officer from the Atomic Energy Commission had come here to do a site review and asked to speak to President Hanna, and so Haynes and I took this man, Glenn somebody, I've slipped on the last name right this minute, over, and somewhere through the interview Atomic Energy Commission persons ask Hanna, well, in this proposal you say you're going to provide money to build a building. I'd like to know where you're going to get that money. And Hanna kind of glared at the guy and said, young man, this is a large university that has many resources. And if you put your money on the table, I'll put mine there.
So the building was the last of his worries.
Yeah, so that really silenced that line of conversation.
Yeah.
I'm sure I'm doing an exact quotation. That's very vivid in my memory.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe when you first got here? Was there a cyclotron here already? So you were involved in the first in development of the
Earth? Yes, right. There were two young faculty members doing nuclear physics research. Nobody with any experience in accelerators. And the idea of setting up a cyclotron laboratory, I've learned, came through Milder convincing Hanna that it was a proper thing to do. Milder was then the dean of the, wasn't called the natural science in those days. It was College of Arts and Sciences.
Arts and Sciences.
Yeah. Big college. And an administrative decision had been made to try to have a nuclear physics program. Study committee that had been appointed in the physics department had decided that a heavy ion cyclotron was a window of opportunity, something that the national program was short on.
Mm-hmm.
And that committee wrote a report in 1957, which we have ever since referred to as the Balaam Report.
Balaam Report?
Yeah. Joseph Balaam was a professor who chaired the committee. Based on that report, an initial $150,000 was put into accounts under the control of the physics department for the purpose of upgrading the machine shops and hiring a director.
Mm-hmm. And you were that director?
Yes. Uh-huh. As I understand it, I was the third or fourth person that the job was offered to.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of those, I say third or fourth, because two of them were people I worked for at Oak Ridge.
Oh.
And one was from Rochester. And all three were significantly older than I was. And they had better jobs and didn't choose to come here. For me, it was a fine opportunity. I guess in the spring of 58, I would have been 29. So a green kid in many ways. But anyway, the university decided to offer me the job after their experiences of how difficult it was to recruit a more mature established professor.
Mm-hmm. How did you have any preconceptions of Michigan State and the research climate here before you came? Or,
well, the thing that was most attractive to me was the existence of the Mystic, the computer, which von Tersch and his group of bright young men had built. Was not quite as big as the computer we were using in Oak Ridge, but used the same language. Mm-hmm. And so it was very easy to transfer codes and things to that computer. And it was really the computer work that let us successfully get money to build the cyclotron. Like we developed a system for improving the way the beam comes out of the machine so that the cyclotron could become a lot more accurate in its use in nuclear physics experiments.
Mm-hmm. When the when you first developed that, was there did you do computer modeling? I mean, we use that now, and that's what was done prior to development.
Been doing it ever since.
Before you broke out the hardware.
Yes, right. And after a year, succeeded in persuading a colleague, Mort Gordon, who's also still here, although retired. I worked with him in Oak Ridge. He had come to Oak Ridge as a summer visitor from the University of Florida. And with a lot of talk, a year after I came, he came for an interview in the middle of the winter from Florida. I helped him put his overcoat on. And it felt like it weighed about a half a pound.
Not much protection for the Michigan winter.
It was a pretty cold, pretty cold day when they got off the airplane. Anyway, talked him into it.
In those early years, did you face any difficulty in getting funding, or was it relatively easy after the first grant? Or,
well, after the first grant, it certainly got easier. The first grant was to do further computer modeling of the system, and that was a big grant for those days. The biggest one the physics department had.
This is $150,000.
Yeah, yeah. Well, $150,000 was from MSU.
Oh, okay.
All right. That was but
that was different,
and that had to pay salaries, like pay my salary and such things. But the this grant was $186,000 from the Atomic Energy Commission. And there was a big contest with the University of Michigan. After hearing of the MSU proposal, they decided they needed a new cyclotron. They did have an old one. The Atomic Energy Commission didn't have money for either proposal, but the University of Michigan had a strong friend in Congressman from Detroit, whose name I can't immediately say, although mm-hmm. it's in the congressional record, so it could be looked up. Anyway, he earmarked money, pork barrel would be the customary phrase for that. he was chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that handled the Atomic Energy Commission. And yes, they got money then through that process in 1960. And MSU was passed over. Mm-hmm. University of Michigan made a proposal to Professor Haynes that he assigned me to work in Ann Arbor on leave. Mm-hmm. We turned that down very quickly. And particularly with Milder, who had become vice president for research, we spent a lot of time traveling to Washington, talking to the Atomic Energy Commission, the Office of Naval Research, and the National Science Foundation. Finally in fall of 61, NSF made a grant of $700,000, which was approximately half the amount that we needed mm-hmm. for the cyclotron, but it was labeled as the first half. So the financial situation was then on a firm basis for building the cyclotron. Mm-hmm.
And what was there a deadline that you were expected to meet in terms of the actual construction, or?
Sure. Yeah. With some quotes unexpected.
Get the money.
When you're doing something that you've never done before, schedules are always have lots of question marks on them. Mm-hmm. And I'm from Virginia, and the mountain, the Shenandoah Valley, and the geography of East Lansing, was just the exact opposite of the kind of place I thought I'd like to live. Mm-hmm. I came here thinking I'd build a cyclotron in about 3 years, mm-hmm. and then move on to someplace else. And it took 3 years to get the money. Mm-hmm. Took another five to build the cyclotron instead of three. And by that time, I'd gotten more used to life in East Lansing. Mm-hmm. over the years, had a good many proposals from other institutions that wanted to move into nuclear physics, but never came to one that I really liked better than the situation here.
Seems to be a common theme in talking with different people, that people came here, Walter Adams, for example, with the expectations that they'd stay for just a short period of time, and then mm-hmm. 30 years later, yeah. they're still here.
Yeah.
So it sounds like your experience was similar.
Yes,
similar right. to that in some respects. Well, what about the first cyclotron that you built? What were any special problems? Obviously, you're starting from scratch. There's no blueprints, or were you working from some ideas that?
We did the design of that machine. Mm-hmm. Had some good engineering assistance from a group of engineers in Berkeley, California, who had formed a private company. They had been key people in building the early cyclotrons in Berkeley, and had moved off to a private organization, Brobeck mm-hmm. and Associates was the name of that company. And yeah, so I've got books from Brobeck sticking up there on the shelf. working together with them, we developed the engineering details of a cyclotron with this improved extraction system, mm-hmm. which our computer modeling had developed. And so that's what we set about building.
Mm-hmm.
Had to build this building first. I have a picture standing right out there with my two sons in an alfalfa field in 1961.
61.
Yeah. So the Shaw Hall was the only building in this vicinity. Mm-hmm. And the site had moved around several times.
Mm.
President Hanna had this, he liked his early morning breakfast meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And we had several concerning the location of this building. It was originally planned to be an addition to the old physics building on North Campus.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. Thought it would be too crowded over there, and that was a very correct intuition. He'd walk over to the map. These meetings were typically in Kellogg Center for breakfast, and put his finger down someplace, and everybody would march off and develop architectural studies.
Check out the site.
Yeah, check out the site.
Mm-hmm.
So finally his finger landed on this place. Mm-hmm. I think it was the third serious study which he had done, which the university planners had done. And this one looked good to me.
Mm-hmm.
The building construction, it took the architect something like 18 months to get the bid documents
mm-hmm.
put together. So that was an unexpected delay. Then construction started, took a bit over a year to build the building, and finally in the fall of 63, we moved in to the building.
During construction, what was your main work on the cyclotron itself? Were you doing a computer modeling at that time, or?
Doing a lot of that. Gordon was the, and we had brought another person from Oak Ridge, Thelma Arnett, as the, so initially I wrote a lot of the programs, and Gordon guided the mathematics of the process, and then Arnett came in and took over as our first programmer, and another student, David Johnson, who ended up working here something in the territory of 40 years. He just retired.
Student at that time.
Yeah. A very eccentric student.
First cyclotron, did it meet the expectations that you had intended for it? Or?
Oh, it did, yes. Mm-hmm. It became a big success. Mm-hmm. We were also hiring nuclear physics faculty, and made one or two bad choices, which we corrected, and made a lot of good choices. These guys who are now distinguished professors were largely hired in that first recruiting wave.
Mm-hmm. So the cyclotron itself became a magnet, pun intended, for that.
Yes, right.
Mm-hmm. For that expansion of the faculty.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The what was the output of that earlier machine?
Forte was making more accurate measurements.
Okay.
Of nuclear properties than anyone else had been able to make. And that was a key component of the frontier of nuclear physics at that time. And so pretty quickly the lab became known as a leading international center of nuclear physics research. It was a beehive of activity. You come in here now in the evening, and you're lucky if you find one professor in the building. Mm-hmm. In those days, it would be typical to have either all the faculty here or all but one or two mm-hmm. here working in the evenings with their students. Lots of energy, the energy of youth, and a machine with some unique characteristics, so that it's like a new, a better microscope. Mm-hmm. What you see is something that no one's seen before with a better microscope. Mm-hmm. And so get in there and see it before someone else catches up. See it and publish it.
How your early publishing about it, what was your main venue for publication about your work here?
Oh, well, let's see, so the lab has its two sides, the accelerator builders and the nuclear physics group. And so the nuclear physics group would publish in Physical Review. Was and is the prestige journal of nuclear physics in the world. Accelerator work was largely published in conference proceedings. Mm-hmm. A series of cyclotron conferences. The 16th of those is going to be here next May.
Oh, really? Has it been here before?
Yes, okay. It's here in 1984. Mm-hmm. Those conferences national and international accelerator conferences are the places where the accelerator work is documented.
Mm-hmm. What was in the early years, what was the international component that scholars from around the world were?
Yes, almost immediately. We started pulling people. Our first postdoc was from Germany.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
And was in the accelerator group, and has become a distinguished citizen mm-hmm. of the world community. Mm-hmm. Moved off to be a professor at the University of Maryland. Mm.
Who was that?
Martin Reiser, R-E-I-S-E-R. Yeah. And he's not retirement age.
what was the in the developing the funding after you had gotten the first the first one running? Mm-hmm. Was it easier to get subsequent grants from the government or?
Oh yes, right. Mm-hmm. In the early years, it was a very nice phase of growth. So operating grants grew from, I think maybe the first operating grant was something like $250,000 for a year. And then they sort of worked their way up to $700,000 by the late 60s. Mm-hmm. And then one of the recurring federal budget crunches came along. And things held steady at 700,000, and several nuclear physics laboratories at universities were closed to make the work match the budget. Cyclotrons have a lot of fixed costs, and so if you have two of them and don't have money, have half enough money. You know, it's nonsense to run each of them at half pace because mm-hmm. of the fixed costs don't change. Mm-hmm. So you pick one to close. And that process has been going on steadily ever since. Mm-hmm. The number of cyclotron laboratories has just been declining in the country. So it was down to two a few years ago, and now University of Indiana is being closed.
Mm-hmm. And, so will this be the last one?
So this is going to be the last university mm-hmm. accelerator laboratory. And, right now it looks like we have a promising future. Like the new project is just being finished, and mm-hmm. so if that comes to pass, why, or if it operates as it's supposed to, there'll probably be 10 years of exploitation of that machine, mm-hmm. and then there'll be another serious crunch point where. That'll be what we're building now will be an old facility. And what takes its place?
Mm-hmm. What could you talk a little bit about the different generations that the cyclotron has gone through?
Well, yeah, so the first generation.